What, given the same set of circumstances, the results would always be the same. Nothing about nursing strikes me as predictable, she said. Exactly, I replied, taking another bite. I figured I'd go and work in a lab or pharmacy or something. But then I met a nurse when I was in my teens, and the way his mind worked, ready for any eventuality, always thinking five steps ahead, I was in awe. I thought, that's how I want to be. And so I applied for nursing degrees. Sounds like you owe a lot to this nurse. Was he a family friend? I thought of Mr. and Mrs. Tonga and their charming country house in Hursley. How they sat me down at their dining table and talked me through my GCSE options. Explained the steps, and most importantly, the student financing options to start a medical career. The first people to talk about my future like it wasn't doomed. Of all the houses I lived in growing up, that one felt the most like home. What a shame it only lasted 5 months. Something like that, I said. Grace scratched at a blue plaster on her thumb. She blushed when I noticed it. Perk of the job. I almost amputated my thumb last night. She pulled back the plaster to show me her war wound. I inspected it the only way I know how. Like a nurse. Minor laceration. Clean edges. No signs of infection. When I looked up, she was fighting a smile. What? I asked. Cardiology might have been a bad choice, don't you think? I bet one look from you sets all the pacemakers off. Is that your way of telling me I get your heart racing? She bit her bottom lip. Maybe. Grace insisted we split the bill, and as we left the restaurant, she slipped her hand into mine. There was a rough plan to get hot chocolate at a parlour that served cakes the size of bricks, but when we arrived, the queue was into the street. That's when she darted into the convenience store next door, using me as a human basket, handing me flour, eggs, sugar, cinnamon. A short walk later, and we were back at my house. So, the equipment is a little sparser than I expected. Grace held up a novelty miniature cheese grater and an egg timer shaped like a frog. In my defence, I usually ate in the hospital cafeteria. But I think I can make something work with these, she said. In one hand, she held up a spatula thing and the mixing bowl I used for popcorn. I took a seat on a stool while Grace laid out her equipment. I was swiftly hit in the face with an apron that must have belonged to Ali, because I'd never seen it before. Absolutely not, slacker, she said. Up on your feet. I smirked as I pulled it over my head and tied it. I'm seeing a dominant side to you, Grace. I like it. Good cooking relies on two key principles, timing and seasoning, she said. You've got to be dominant when you work in a kitchen. If you take time for pleasantries, things get burned. No pleasantries, no burning. Yes, chef. I didn't have scales, so Grace measured the ingredients with an assortment of mugs and different sized spoons. Then she started putting things in a saucepan and turned on the heat. I consider myself a smart man, but she worked so meticulously and so fast that I felt like I was chasing my tail to keep up. The contents of the pan looked like a chemistry experiment gone awry. Now is the fun part, she said, whipping out the spatula again. We eat it? She laughed. We beat the shit out of it. I hesitated. Is that a joke? No. Grace worked hard and fast until the mixture took a doughy form, then stepped aside to make space. Your turn, she said, handing me the spatula. I made two moves and quickly got it wrong. Harder and faster, she said. Use the full weight of your palm, I know it's sticky, but you need to work it as firmly as you can to get a perfectly stiff churro. I couldn't seem to respond with anything that wasn't obscene, so I kept my mouth closed. Grace stood beside me, covering my hands with hers. Like this. It took so much more exertion than I thought it would. I held back a grunt. She sensed it. Tiring you out already? Well, this doesn't bode well. As I laughed, her eyes glowed, as though my laughter was hard-earned. It wasn't. My attention drifted to her mouth. She had the most perfect Cupid's bow. Her bold lipstick had faded to the sexiest shade of pink. The urge to kiss her was overpowering. Not yet, I told myself. We worked together seamlessly. Scents of buttery dough filled the room. Then she stepped around me to create a makeshift piping bag out of cling film, doing the best she could to squeeze out the mixture. But with no nozzle on the end, she couldn't recreate the iconic star shape. Instead, she curled out what looked like long, thin penises. Not my best work, she said, poking one. I think they look delicious. She scrunched her nose in disbelief. Wow, you must really like me, she said with a laugh. I didn't deny it. She waited for me to, but I simply smiled and said, who wouldn't? The flush on her cheeks rivaled the shade of the strawberries as she opened the packet and began washing them. You'll need a bain-marie, she said. I need to do what to Marie? She laughed again. If I could have collected those laughs in my back pocket, I would have. A saucepan of boiling water and a bowl, Grace explained, rooting around for something sufficient. Have you lived here long? She asked, as I broke chocolate chunks into the bowl. About 5 years. I took the lease after I graduated and started working at the hospital. It's been one long revolving door of roommates since. One day, I'll tell you about the guy who continuously sleepwalked into my bedroom in the middle of the night. Her jaw dropped. Oh, God, that's horrendous. Especially given the fact he slept naked. She laughed, then paused. I hope that didn't have any influence on your decision to live with a woman this time. Oh, God, no. I grimaced. And not in a mean way, in an alley way. Like hearing someone say they fancy your little sister. There's also a lock on my door now. Lesson learned. I explained that the alley situation was always going to be temporary, that I should be able to start looking for a house to buy before the end of the year, all being well. You saved an entire house deposit at 25 on a nurse's salary. Did you eat nothing but air for the last decade? Pretty much, I replied. Our eyes met. I never told anyone the truth about why I had enough money for a deposit. I knew people made their own assumptions because of it. Trust fund was whispered in my presence more than once. It never bothered me what anyone thought. But in that moment, I considered telling her the whole dark, honest story of why my savings account had been bolstered by a large compensation payout. Then Grace smiled, and I realized I'd do anything to keep it there. Even tell a white lie. That's genuinely amazing. What sort of house are you looking for? She asked. Anything, was the answer to that. I loved this little terraced house, but it never felt like home. On the whim of a greedy landlord, it could be ripped out of my hands. I couldn't live like that anymore. Something local, with potential, I said. A project would be amazing, something I can spend my free time refurbishing, make my own, you know? I love that, she said. She added cream and a pinch of salt to the now melted chocolate. Are your family local? I paused for so long, Grace mistook it as incompetence and grabbed the spoon from me to stir. Not exactly. You have two brothers, right? I liked the fact she'd remembered that from the first night. Yeah, they're both in the army now. Away more than not. As children, neither of my brothers had a penchant for toy guns or rolling miniature tanks across imaginary battlefields. The battlefields we knew were not fictitious. Our parents ensured that. But the military provided them with the things they desperately needed at 16 that no one else was willing to give them. Stability and a roof over their heads. If I hadn't been 6 years younger, I'd have most likely been forced to follow the same path. And your parents? She asked. They're dead. It flew out of my mouth. A lie I'd told 100 times. One so big that no one thinks to question it. A full stop I desperately needed. But now that it was out there, this huge fabrication, I wanted to grab hold of it and shove it back inside me. Oh, God, I'm so sorry, she said quickly. We don't have to talk about it if you don't want to. I nodded. It might be okay. It wasn't like she would ever meet them. I dipped my finger into the chocolate. I'd rather talk about how amazing the sauce is. It's good, she asked, a noticeable pleasure washing over her. She dipped her finger too, then took a long, slow suck. I swear it was the quickest I'd ever been turned on. I desperately needed to stop thinking about her lips on me or I was going to embarrass myself. More cream. Grace poured another spoonful into the bowl. She kept her eyes fixed on mine, playful, as if she knew all I could think about was her tongue on my skin. She directed me around the kitchen as I, the man who barely knew how to boil an egg, deep-fried churros and made not one but two sauces before pouring them carefully into little pots for dipping. We dived in. Grace hopped onto the counter next to me, mesmerized while I ate. I love watching people enjoy my food. Is that weird? When it tastes this good, absolutely not. She dipped a churro in the strawberry sauce. Someday I'd like to open my own restaurant. Put these on the menu and I'll be a customer for life. She smiled. I think I've reached the point where I'm ready to stand on my own 2 feet. I've had it planned in my head for a while. If only it was as easy as that. I love cooking and I know I'd nail that side of it, but it feels like such a huge step to be a proper entrepreneur. Make a business out of it, employ people. I've never really trusted myself enough that I'd be able to hack it. I got lost in the hopeful look in Grace's eyes, then dipped another churro. Well, you've already nailed the cooking side of things. Isn't that what matters? Everything else you can learn. You should do it. Make it happen. A pink tint spread across the apples of her cheeks, as if I was the first person ever to affirm her dreams. The thought unsettled me. You're only saying that because you're on a date with me. Absolutely not. No, I wouldn't bullshit you, especially not about something important. So we should agree to tell each other the truth? Grace asked with abrupt seriousness. I swallowed. Instant regret burned through me for lying about my parents. But what was the alternative? Let her see how broken I was on a first date. Yeah, right. I guess, I said. In that case, I want to tell you, finally, that you have a ginormous blob of chocolate on your shirt, she said. I glanced down, confused not to see anything until she smeared a thick brown line across my chest. Oh my God, I said, laughing. I looked up, and Grace had a smile bigger than I'd ever seen, her chest vibrating from holding in the laughter. I dipped my hand in the chocolate and dragged my fingers along her arm. Grace gasped at the contact, the heat, my touch. Then she let loose, jumping off the counter, grabbing the bowl with vengeance in her eyes. The laughter came thick and fast from both of us as we battled with warm melted chocolate. It was on our faces, a handprint on my arse. It coagulated in my hair, trickled down the soft skin of her legs. I held Grace tight by the waist, feet off the ground, the bowl balanced above her head, ready to drip. "Surrender," I demanded. She squealed with laughter. "Make me." I spun her to face me. The bowl hit the floor with a crash, sending chocolate splattering up the walls and onto the units and rolled to some unseen place. But all I could think about was the way she pressed against me, the way her hands looped around my neck. "You have a little something." She gestured to my entire face. "So do you," I said. My eyes dropped to her mouth. "I've been dying to kiss you all night." Grace gripped me tighter. "What are you waiting for?" I stepped forward until her backside hit the counter, lifted her gently and perched her on the edge, her knees wide as I slid between them. She tilted her face upwards, but I delayed the inevitable. Savoring the way her eyelids dropped, the way her insanely gorgeous mouth reached for mine. I smiled and kissed her. And as Grace whimpered into my mouth, somehow tasting sweeter than chocolate and strawberries, she grabbed my arse and pulled me flush with her. At the hard contact, it became a frenzy. She tugged off my shirt, fingers fumbling with my belt. I pulled her dress over her head. God, her skin. So soft and smooth. I wanted to kiss every inch of her. "This is fast," I said between long, deep kisses. I didn't slow down as I was unclasping her bra. "Not fast enough." Grace groaned as I dropped to her chest, filling my mouth with her perfect tits. She kept arching closer, saying "please" over and over, the sweetest word I'd ever heard. I was ready, raging even, but I wanted to be certain. "You're sure about this? About me?" I trailed a finger along the seam of her underwear. "God, yes," Grace moaned as she kissed me deeper. I slipped my hand under the fabric, loving the way her head fell back, her eyes closing with pleasure. I wanted her to feel a fraction of what I felt right now as she rocked against me, kissing me in a way that was going to change my life forever. Within minutes, she was begging me to take her right there on the kitchen counter, a core memory created. The kind you replay on a loop for all eternity. This wasn't the plan. I wanted to do things differently for once, to take her out again, prove I had more to offer than a quick screw. I'd been there, done that plenty of times before. I wanted her to fall for me first, because I knew I was already sky high without a parachute. But I am a mere mortal. And there was no way in hell I was going to refuse the best request I'd ever heard. I reached for the lonely condom in my wallet, and within seconds, I was inside her. Her soft sigh was enough to make me feel like I could glow in the dark. It started slow. Me holding back, holding on, making sure she was comfortable. Studying her every whimper, swearing to myself that I wasn't going to mess this up. This wasn't about me. But as she gripped her fingers into the skin of my back, licked chocolate from my jaw, I was a goner. The dishes on the counter began shaking. Utensils crashed to the floor, strawberries were squashed into limbs, but none of it mattered. I kept my focus, finding the perfect angle to make her curse, giving everything I had so she got off first. And she did. I made sure of it. Holy shit, I gasped afterwards as Grace slumped against me. That was... I put my palm on the kitchen cabinet to steady my shaking knees. I was still inside her, desperate for every last second. Fuck, I'm speechless. I closed my eyes and prayed that now she'd had all of me, she wasn't done. She looked up at me with a dreamy, satisfied smile. Breathless, she said. I kind of like you, Henry. I took her chin between my fingers and kissed her gently. I kind of like you too, I replied. Like wasn't a strong enough word. The next morning, I left Grace sleeping soundly in my bed and came downstairs wearing an old hoodie and an I can't believe my luck grin. After leaving the kitchen, we had showered away the chocolate and then fallen into my bed, soaking my sheets through to the mattress with our wet bodies, having sex twice more before falling asleep in a naked tangle. I was bone-achingly tired, but I'd stayed awake for as long as I could. I didn't want to waste a minute of her. Ali was sitting at the dining table eating cereal. She smiled when she saw me. A knowing smile. You were way too loud, but this technically isn't my house, so I can't be mad about it. Smile. And I'm a little ashamed to admit that from the moment Grace walked through the door until 2 seconds ago, it was as if I'd completely forgotten that Ali lived here too. Morning, she sang. I kept my face neutral. Good morning, Ali. Fun night. She glanced at Grace's handbag, which I was retrieving from the side of the sofa. I laughed to myself. You could say that. Ali turned her attention to her phone. I don't know what kind of food porn happened in that kitchen, but you can never berate me for that messy house party ever again. My stomach seized with embarrassment. Even in the dark, it had looked a state. I dreaded to think how bad it was in the morning light. I'll get to it. As soon as I say goodbye to Grace. Ali shook her head as she laughed, then finished her breakfast and assembled her gym bag. I didn't think she was going to call me out on our bet, but as she reached the front door, she stopped abruptly. Oh, Henry? Yeah? Not to sound all gangster, but I expect my money by the end of the week. Cash. All I could do was concede. Sure thing.
Chapter 10, Grace, Now. 3 days post-glitch, and I am well and truly back to my humble beginnings. If someone had told me that I'd lose my restaurant and end up back in the kitchen where I had my first culinary break, underpaid and overworked, I'd have probably burst into tears. It was like a live-action nightmare. You're back in your school gymnasium, being dragged to your assigned seat for a test you haven't studied for. Torture. Except, instead of my old head teacher, or dad, admonishing me for yet another screw-up, it was my old boss, Jean Paris, founder and head chef of Le Bleu, screaming at me down the phone, telling me if I wasn't at work in the next 10 minutes, he would fire my ass. Which I assume means he'll sack me. But his English is sometimes shaky. So he could also mean he plans to brand my backside with a spider burner. Such a nice man. But his scare tactics worked, because I ran straight there. A 20-minute walk done in 10. It takes me a few minutes to cool down and get my bearings, remember my locker combination. But once I do, I'm back in the kitchen. Like muscle memory. With the busy evening cook already in full swing, Jean-Paris puts me at the back on pot washing, a punishment for being late, to remind me I am never irreplaceable. I keep my head down and my mouth closed. It's not like I can afford to lose this job, even though the scalding hot suds remind me why exactly I was so desperate to get out of this place. I once loved it. I went through 5 interview rounds and fought off some of the best young chefs in the country to get this role. I worked hard, paying my trainee dues. I cleaned ovens. I peeled potatoes, all with a smile on my face. I kept my longing glances at the award-winning pots of bisque to a bare minimum. I never complained, and for good reason. Turnover in kitchens is high. There's only so many times one person can cook from the same seasonal menus on a quarterly loop until it becomes a bit dull. I knew it wouldn't be hard to work my way up if I persevered. But every time the chance for advancement came up, I was overlooked. I had the same experience, same training, same passion. The only certifiable difference between me and the candidates Jean-Paris promoted was that I was a woman. I once asked him why, after a couple of gins at the Christmas party, and wished I hadn't. He sighed and looked at me as if it should have been obvious.
"Because it won't be long until you leave to have children and don't come back. This happened with every woman your age I've promoted. It'll happen again. I'm not investing in you only to have you trade me out for mushy peas and breast milk."
I knew it was illegal. I knew he shouldn't be able to get away with saying shit like that, let alone actioning it. But what was I going to do? I didn't have the money to fight him, didn't have the resources, and technically, I didn't have any proof either. But it changed me. My effort waned. I stopped trying to impress him. And in his eyes, that was the most insulting thing I could ever do. So yeah, old Grace was on her final warning, banished to the back of the kitchen next to the work experience kids with braces. But new Grace is going to see this for what it is. A stepping stone to something better. All I need is a great reference. Then I can head on my merry way. Look for a job with career progression. A new challenge. A kitchen without a misogynistic pig at the helm. And the only way I'm going to get one is to grin and bear it. Which is what I do now, at the end of the cook, as Jean-Paris screams my name until I follow him into his office. I pull a stack of menus from the chair and take a seat. A tall man, he towers over me when sitting down. "I've got a problem." "That makes 2 of us," I almost say. He speaks to the screen of his laptop, typing away.
"There's a charity event Friday night, a big auction with lots of local businesses to fundraise for something. I forget the details now, but I've offered our catering services and I need you to work."
"Okay." Jean-Paris pauses, and I realise he's expecting resistance. I was so exhausted by this point 5 years ago, so fed up every time I walked through that door, that all the money in the world couldn't persuade me to do overtime.
"Do you need me to prep, or?" I ask.
"Sunita is out sick. She was going to work the event with me, front of house, represents the restaurant."
"So you need me to?"
"I need you to put on a nice dress, drop the moody, I've got a chip on my shoulder attitude, and fucking smile for me. Can you do that?"
I bite the inside of my cheek. The only thing worse than not telling him to go screw himself is the memory of closing my restaurant, the look of disappointment in my staff's eyes when I let them down, the feeling of failure deep in my bones. New path, Grace. New path. A shiny gold reference almost floats above his grey, wispy hair. "No problem," I say, with a smile so sweet it could rot teeth. On Friday, as instructed, I put on a floor-length black dress and a smile and arrive early. The hotel is one of those copy-and-paste ones every city has. A shiny glass front, dated navy carpets. But the event room is pretty lavish, with giant crystal chandeliers in the vaulted ceiling. As I walk in, I get a daunting feeling, like I've forgotten my keys or left my straightener on. The spine tingle you get before a horror movie jump scare. Which is absurd, because I know nothing about this event. I didn't work it before. I wasn't even asked. I tell myself I'm overthinking. It wouldn't be the first time. I join my colleagues, all looking as miserable as I feel, putting the finishing touches to the assembly line of trays. While the purpose of the event is to fundraise for a new family centre on the children's ward at the hospital, Jean-Paris's goals are entirely self-serving. He wants to get his name out there, increase pre-bookings, and he's gone all out with his offering, showcasing the best of the menu. Slices of filet mignon soaked in red wine jus, buttered lobster tails, sticky glazed chicken balls. But it's very meat-heavy. And where are the alternate options? I ask, looking around. Vegan, veggie, gluten-free? Are they on separate trays? Vegetarian ones are over there, he replies, pointing to a small stack of cheesy mushroom favours. And the rest? Everyone looks at me as though I've grown a second head. Seriously? Jean-Paris sighs with frustration.
We're not here to cater to the fussy.
If anyone brings it up, hand them a piece of lettuce, he replies, tone sharp. He knows I'm right, and he's either overlooked it or very likely he doesn't care. But I am the help, not the hero. There's not much I can do. With the fundraiser in full swing, the ballroom is filled with people dressed in tuxedos and cocktail dresses. There are hotel waiters, of course, but Jean-Paris insisted on the personal touch. All I am thinking about is my reference as I schmooze like I've never schmoozed before. I keep a Hollywood smile fixed on my face. I hand out food, repeating the name Le Bleu so many times I'm no longer sure I'm pronouncing it properly. People begin crowding to grab the little squares of heaven, a punter's review I expertly weave into every introduction. Come to Le Bleu any time, I tell everyone, next to the statue of the man on the horse. My first tray of appetizers gone in record time, I make my way back to the kitchen. I grab two more trays and head for the narrow corridor to the event room. That's when I collide with a concrete wall of human.
Ah!
I yelp. I lift the trays at the last second, above my head. They tilt a steep left, then right. A seesaw with ludicrously expensive cuisine in jeopardy. With epic skill, I get them straight. The only damage, a flyaway piece of parsley. Holy crap, that was close.
Whoa, that was lucky, the man says.
Yeah, I know, I almost... I look up and freeze. The man is Henry. In a stomach-flipping black suit, with a light smattering of stubble that wasn't there at the party, he looks absolutely breathtaking. You, I say. It's the most loaded word that's ever left my mouth. You, the love of my life. You, the man who broke me. You, who doesn't remember a second of it. You, he fires back. The girl who destroyed my toilet.
I didn't...
He's laughing. I know. I grip the trays until the metal turns warm. This can't be happening. Why are you here? He narrows his eyes in accusation. Why are you here? I raise the food again. I'm working.
So am I.
He flashes me a name badge on his jacket with the word volunteer written on it. I'm assisting the auctioneer, and apparently he can't function without a can of Diet Cola. Heat floods my face. Henry's not here to torture my broken heart. He's here because he works at the hospital. I take a deep breath and compose myself.
Well, I'm glad we got that cleared up, I say quickly.
I position the parsley back in its place. I'm trembling. Henry watches me.
Are you okay?
He asks.
I'm fine.
Why wouldn't I be?
Because this is the second time we've met, and both times you've acted like I've slapped you around the face with a wet fish.
I bark a laugh.
Huh. I can't think straight. Fish? Really?
Henry smiles. I mean... I've never done it, obviously, but I can imagine the reaction would be pretty similar to the one I keep getting from you. My throat tightens, and I'm not sure if it's laughter or tears threatening to spill out. I need to get a hold on my emotions. I have an entire evening to get through. And knowing Henry is here is going to send me into overdrive.
I'm busy. There's no bad blood.
No fish-slapping vendetta, I promise.
Grace!
Jean-Paris appears at the kitchen door, clicking his fingers. He points to the event room, then disappears. It's the first time ever one of his blunt demands has been met with relief.
I've got to go,
I say, heading for my escape route, not looking back, not even when Henry teasingly calls behind me. It was nice to meet you. Again. Within the hour, the room has transformed into a buzzy, tipsy affair. The organisers clearly know that alcoholic lubrication is the best way to get people's hands deeper into their pockets. But with drink comes hunger, which means I'm everyone's favourite attendee. I'm swamped by hands as they dive onto my trays. No sooner do I grab a refill that people crowd me, reaching for more. At this point, I should just open the kitchen doors and let them sway inside like famished zombies. I haven't seen Henry again. Not that I've been looking. I haven't. I'm moving forward with my life. New path. Over it. And definitely not snapping my neck in the direction of the lectern every time the curtain behind it moves an inch. Which is why it's so odd that someone would need to literally wave their hand in front of my face to get my attention. Which they are. I smile brightly at the petite, dark-haired woman in front of me.
Sorry to interrupt.
She glances at the lectern and sees nothing of interest.
Is anything here vegan? I'm so hungry, I'm shaking.
It's the kind of request that makes every one of my natural instincts kickstart, being a feeder by nature. I glance at my tray, which contains a few stray prawns and a dollop of what I think is mustard. Then I look for Jean-Pierre and spot him chatting to someone who looks like a used car salesman.
It's not, but if we're quick, I can help you out.
We walk to the kitchen. She tells me her name is Felicity, that she's a doctor. It's a speedy turnaround, where I dive into the fridge and pull out the only things I can guarantee are vegan. Some spiced hummus and a handful of crackers. She thanks me like I've saved her life. It's not the most exciting food, but it's something. I once got so hungry at an event like this, I contemplated eating the toilet tissue. I joke.
You're a vegan?
She asks, like she stumbled upon another human on a faraway planet.
One of us.
Vegetarian. Well, except for the odd bite I'm forced to taste at work. I think I'll be vegan one day, when I can finally let go of cheddar.
Lactose intolerant,
she smiles, pointing to herself.
Cheese is my godforsaken enemy. Oh, that's rough. Yeah, and it's everywhere, lurking in every meal. I eat so much bloody salad, it's unbelievable.
I have some great recipes, I say. I can totally help you out.
At Le Bleu, she asks.
I almost say it. I almost say the lucky one. It's like taking a punch to the chest. The disappointment, the hurt, the guilt.
Yeah.
I hand her a business card. Give us a call. We can work something out. I can't see Jean-Pierre letting me experiment, but it'll put me in his good books to have a customer certifiably traced back to me. In the background, I hear the distant rumble of talking into a mic. I leave Felicity to graze for a little longer and make myself seen. The auctioneer starts the bidding on a spa day for two. I somehow know that the next lot is a golf day, but I still can't put my finger on why all of this feels so familiar. Maybe Henry told me about it. Maybe he got chatting to someone there and I was jealous. Grace at 25 could make herself jealous of the wind against his skin. And then I heard a burst of coughing erupt from the crowd, and it hits me. Someone choked. And not an, oh, excuse me, that went down the wrong way kind. I'm talking red-faced, call an ambulance type of choking. I heard about it the next day at work, how the entire fundraiser was disrupted. Understandably, medical emergencies will do that. The coughing continues. The chatter of the crowd grows quieter.
Can someone get some water?
The auctioneer says into his microphone. Jean-Pierre runs to the bar. I'm in a room full of doctors and nurses. There is a sea of trained professionals and yet no one is moving. They're all watching someone choke. The thought slams into my mind. Maybe this is why I woke up 5 years earlier. A pulsing heroism rages through me. A divine reason. I'm here to save a life.
Oh God!
Someone in the crowd cries. And without thinking, I'm rushing towards the voice. The strained chorus grunts.
I know the Heimlich,
I'm shouting. People step aside. Nothing makes people move faster than a woman charging towards you like an angry bull. There's an older lady in front of me. She's clutching at her necklace of pretty pearls. She looks at me with fear in her eyes, mouth open, and I instantly know what to do. I wrap my hands around her slim waist, my hands meeting at her diaphragm. I start, pulling sharply up into her chest. She's so tiny, I lift her off the floor. It's actually quite violent saving someone's life. The strap on my top snaps off, dress slipping down to reveal my ugly beige stick-on bra. My makeup smudges against the back of her silver hair, but still, I persist. A lump of chicken hits the floor. It must have been projected from the back of her throat. I release my grip on the woman. There are gasps from the onlookers, hands over mouths. The petite woman still in my arms, shaking like a sick dog. "You're okay," I say to her, smiling. "It's dislodged. You can breathe normally."
"I wasn't joking,"
she tries to scream at me, but it comes out no louder than a whisper. There's a flash of red in my eyes, panic in full flow. She wheezes again, and I notice another woman standing beside her, EpiPen poised. A young guy in a baby blue suit bends slowly, picking up the lump of chicken that's fallen from his plate. Oh, bollocks.
"She has a shellfish allergy,"
a man yells at me as the woman is escorted aside for treatment.
"We were told this food was safe for her."
Jean-Paris turns to me, in front of the entire crowd, eyes murderous.
"Grace, I gave you clear instructions on allergens. You gave this woman shellfish, and then you assaulted her. This is unacceptable,"
Jean-Paris hisses, while hundreds of eyes judge me. There's molten shame coursing through me at having grabbed that poor woman, for trusting a hazy memory of a conversation from 5 years ago over a room full of medical professionals. I barely realise what Jean-Paris is doing until it's too late.
"We do not tolerate this type of negligence at Le Bleu. I will personally see that you never work in my kitchen again."
I stutter. "But I was out back. And I always check." Jean-Paris' face turns red with rage, the type of fire that's fueled by desperation to save his business, his reputation. I know it well.
"Enough. You are fired with immediate effect."
Humiliation rises from my toes, coiling around my muscles as camera phones zoom onto my face. Someone tuts. Another shakes their head in disgust.
"Please, everyone,"
Jean-Paris says to the crowd with a smile. Only I seem to notice the way his mustache twitches like a cartoon villain's.
"Do not let this spoil our beautiful evening.
You have my full assurances that the food has been made in accordance with strict health and safety regulations. I offer a complimentary bottle of wine for anyone who makes a reservation."
The crowd turns from me, and the auctioneer resumes the golf day bidding. I look down and see that my sticky beige bra is still on full display. Kill me now. I grab a tumbler of vodka on the way out and take a seat on a concrete bollard while I fix my dress and order a taxi. It's a 20-minute wait. I take little sips while I try to understand what the hell happened. I'm supposed to have the power of perfect hindsight. Right now, I feel like I have the power of a dry sponge. The hotel doors open. The foyer is lit in warm shades, the sound of intoxicated laughter floating through the air. One solid shadow stands in the doorway, and I know who it is without even looking. The only person whose shape I know better than my own. Henry Dunn. His tie is hanging around his neck like a flimsy scarf, and even though my expression is like a raging thunderstorm, he steps closer.
"So that was," he says. "You really wreak havoc wherever you go, don't you?"
He has no idea how correct he is. I sip again and try to swallow down at least a little of the self-pity I'm feeling.
"I was so sure she was choking," I say, more to myself than Henry. "Either I remembered wrong, or I've altered the future just by being here." Both prospects feel as scary.
"Well, I would like to think you wouldn't do that to an innocent bystander without thinking they're choking," he replies.
"I didn't give her seafood either. I was in the kitchen at the time and I always, always check allergens."
I gesture to the bustling event room inside. It sounds as if the party has continued, but that doesn't mean it has for the poor, unfortunate woman I grappled. "Is she okay?"
"She'll be fine. Physically, anyway," emotionally? Henry makes a face like so-so. The corner of his mouth tips into a smile, but my scowl won't budge. Come on. It is kind of funny.
I'm not ready to joke about it.
Henry sighs and sits on a concrete bollard beside me. I've given him absolutely no indication I want company.
What are you doing?
Waiting for when you're ready to joke about it. I've got a good one lined up. I roll my eyes. Did you come outside purposely to mock me? Well, I came outside because our respective roommates have taken over my living room with paperwork for a big case they're working on.
Oh my God. The Hinkler case. I had forgotten that was around this time. It made headlines across the country, a landmark case that created new legal precedent around surrogacy law. It changed everything for Sasha, propelled her name into the stratosphere.
Henry continues, and I know if I go back there and tell them about my, eventful evening, they're both going to call me an asshole for not making sure you were okay. So you only check if people are okay when you might look like an asshole? Bold to admit, I tease.
That's not why.
Of course, I.
He tugs at his collar.
I feel bad for having such an upper hand, knowing exactly how to put him on the back foot. Relax, I'm joking, I say. You can go back to our roommates and tell them I'm totally fine. Not at all humiliated at having revealed my bra and been fired in a room full of strangers. But hey, the night is young, and I've got a taxi ride to come. Who's to say there won't be more catastrophic, life-altering screw-ups before morning?
Henry sits back, as if he thinks there's a wall behind him. He almost falls off the bollard, then catches himself, grabbing a branch of the hedge as an anchor. Shit, he says.
I laugh. Then he laughs because I'm laughing. And it's one of those cute kind of moments that made me fall in love with him in the first place. And I don't mean his cute awkwardness, which makes his tall, buff exterior feel human, adorable even. I mean the way joy would radiate out of him the second he realized he'd made me laugh or smile. My happiness elevated his happiness. Effortlessly.
Well, there's my dose of humiliation, he says. At least yours didn't cost you your career.
Ah, screw it, he says.
Screw it? How poetic.
His smile falls away.
You're what? Mid-twenties, he says, and I nod, despite it feeling like a lie. That's what your twenties are for. Making mistakes, embarrassing yourself. So you got fired. You'll get another job, I'm sure. A better one. Or something entirely different.
You're going to tell me that when one door closes, another door opens, aren't you?
Hell yeah, I am, he laughs, and waves his arms towards the giant hotel before us.
Doors open everywhere.
The automatic doors he gestures to remain defiantly shut, which makes his proclamation even funnier.
How old are you? I ask, already knowing the answer.
25.
So that's 5 years rammed full of mistakes so far. He nods.
Too many to count.
Your biggest? His green eyes flash at me as if I should know better than to put such a personal question to an almost stranger. But I can't help it. I want to know what he'll say. As if he could possibly admit that his biggest mistake is me, or hurting me, or some other amalgamation from a future that hasn't happened yet.
Taking that one to the grave, I'm afraid.
Biggie, then, I muse. He keeps his gaze to the floor. Just personal. His jaw tightens, the same way it always did when he talked about his family. I never knew why.
Tell me, Grace. It is Grace, isn't it?
My name used to be the last thing he whispered in the dark before he fell asleep, the first words on his lips every morning. Now he isn't even sure what it is.
Yeah, I say. So tell me, Grace, if you could do anything in the world, what would you do?
The answer to that used to be simple. Open my own restaurant. He looks puzzled. And it's not anymore? I think for a moment. About the lost years. I tried to put myself in the mind of the girl I was before, but it's impossible. My life has too many scars to not see the harsh reality.
Permission to say something that might be uncomfortable.
It can't be more uncomfortable than this concrete bollard, he says. I laugh. Ever since I was little, all I've wanted to do was cook. I used to write recipe ideas on all my school books. I would fall asleep at night watching Celine Duval's cookery shows. I studied her career trajectory, how she came from nothing, trained and worked hard, started her own restaurant before she reached 30. Cooking was everything. And when I thought of how my life would turn out, I always saw the same thing. My own restaurant.
What happened?
He asks. What didn't? I twist my glass in my fingers, about to say something out loud that so far I've never had the guts to admit even to myself. I think it was someone else's dream. He doesn't stop me, so I keep going. My parents are hugely successful. They started a business when I was young and it took off in Europe. It became their life. And growing up, I always felt like if I was successful too, then they might take an interest in me. But I struggled. I've never been good academically. I use my hands. I can think things through. But putting them coherently into an essay... I pause. Is this too much? I ask.
No,
he replies. Anyway, I take a sip. I thought if I could take my passion and turn it into something tangible, that maybe they would finally be proud of me. And now, even if I could make it work, even if I became the next Celine Duval, I don't know if I even want their pride anymore. He's staring at me, and his mouth opens into a little O. A shocked, almost confused expression. When he doesn't say anything, I feel my stomach tense as I cringe. I guess I can add oversharing with a stranger to my list of screw-ups today. I hate calling him a stranger. Loathe it. I don't mind, he says. There's another beat where our eyes hold, and I pray, only for a moment, that he feels what I feel. This intensity. That I'm not losing my mind on my own. But then he takes my drink and sips, gently shaking his head. The only thing we share now are a couple of friends and being stuck outside this hotel. And possibly some saliva. I thought you didn't drink, I blurt. When did I say that? He replies. And I realise this version of Henry has never even hinted at it. That I'm thinking of before. A timeline that's becoming more muddled as the days go by. Oh, I say. He takes another small sip and hands the glass back. I mutter something about being confused. When actually, something is clicking into place. Something I always feared. That I never knew Henry Dunn half as well as I thought I did. I check my phone for an update on the taxi. You don't need to wait with me. I'm sure you have other places to be. I'm happy right here. When I turn to look at him, his face erupts with a ginormous smile. Listen, there's this thing in a few weeks at Cheltenham Racecourse. I was wondering if you... Oh, God. He's asking me out. He continues talking about the event, but I can't hear it because I'm instantly transported back there to that day. Of glorious blue skies, grassy toes and sunshine smiles. Henry and I all dressed up. We lost every penny we gambled, and even though he was saving like mad for a house deposit and I barely had 2 £10 notes to rub together, we didn't feel the loss because we were too busy betting on us. It's one of my favourite memories of our relationship. The day I realised I might love him for the rest of my life. I wasn't wrong. I'm sorry, I say. I'm just getting out of a relationship and I'm not sure I'm ready to... His smile transforms into despair. No, I'm sorry, he adds quickly. I should have clarified. I didn't mean as a date. It's a group thing. Ali already invited Sasha and her partner and... I fight the urge to convulse. Wow, I am really going all in on the humiliation tonight. You're not at all. Sorry, it was my fault. I wasn't clear. He's looking at me with complete sincerity. This isn't what it was like between us before. I never questioned his attraction to me back then. Not once. But now I can't place it. Maybe hot mess Grace doesn't do it for him. Understandable. Can I think about it? I say. I'm going to have my hands full job hunting. Of course, he smiles. Let Sasha know and I'm sure she'll make arrangements with Ali. The silence between us grows heavy, despite the uptick in laughter from beyond the hotel walls. Was it a bad breakup? He asks. Takes me a second to realise he means Jason. Is there such a thing as a good one? I haven't... He shifts uncomfortably. I'm friendly with most of the people I've dated. Lucky you. My relationships always seem to end in burning flames. He stares at me. I'm assuming you mean figuratively. But given what I've learned so far about you, I'm wondering... Definitely figuratively. For now. I laugh, then stop myself. He cheated on me. He doesn't miss a beat. Dickhead. Yep. Given the theme of this evening is catastrophic, life-altering mistakes, that was clearly his. I shake my head. Last I heard, they were on the holiday that was supposed to be my birthday present, so I guess he's pretty content right now. Henry grimaces. Sorry. Don't be. It's not your fault. The hotel doors open to reveal Felicity, the vegan I spoke to earlier, standing in the lobby. The lights illuminate her pretty navy dress. Her long black ponytail shines as she moves. She cocks her head to one side when she sees me.
I heard what happened. Are you okay? She asks.
I will be. I take another swig of vodka.
I assume the business card isn't much use now, she says gently.
I could take this opportunity to be petty, to steer a well-intentioned customer away from Le Bleu, to badmouth my former employer in the hopes of creating a dent in their armour. And younger me probably would have. I'd have felt scorned and betrayed and thoroughly believed that that was enough reason to exact my revenge. But I only have space for so many regrets. And the biggest one is sitting on a bollard beside me. You should still book a table, I say. Ask for Sunita and explain our conversation. She'll take care of you, I'm sure.
Thanks, Felicity says, eyes falling to Henry.
Naturally. It's like having a 6'3", dark-haired Adonis in your immediate vicinity. He's not close enough that we look like we're together. Still, she glances between us and I know exactly what she's thinking. This is some guy I met inside, I blurt. He works at the hospital. Felicity's eyes spark as she reads my subtext.
He's not mine.
Not anymore, at least. Henry scrunches his nose at me, then extends a hand to Felicity. Henry Dunn, or some guy, whatever works.
Dr. Felicity Chen, she replies, with a smile that could melt hearts. While I finish my drink, they chat about